and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Peter Salmon, and we will review this week's movie, which is a lighthearted romp, and goodness knows we could use a bit more lightheartedness in these dark days. All you have to do is turn on the news. Or maybe don't turn on the news, because that can only end in sorrow, I think. Anyway, we're going to talk about a happy movie this week, I think. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new romantic comedy, The Lovebirds, which is now streaming on Netflix. That will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to do something unusual for this COVID age. And that's do the regular format of the show. So for the first half of the show, we're going to talk about some of the movie news from the past month. I mean, obviously, things are still kind of low-key because of everything that's happening. There's not a lot of production happening, or rather any production happening. So, all we have to kind of go on is plans for what's coming up in the near future, what's going to be released, how's it going to be released, casting for future projects that will eventually begin filming at some point. Who knows? But from the last month, I have put together a top 10 list of movie news items, and we will start going through them now. Starting with number 10, The Room documentary wins its court case. If you don't know what this is about, there was a documentary, I think it was largely crowdfunded, but it's called Roomful of Spoons, which is about not just the making of The Room, which has of course been like dissected to death. There was a whole book about it, plus a whole movie based on the book. But it was going to go into the background of the man who made The Room, Tommy Wiseau. And apparently the filmmakers who are Richard Harper, Fernando Ferrero McGrath, Mark Racicot, and Richard Towns, they apparently were able to dig up Tommy Wiseau's background, including his real name, his birthplace, his age. All are mysteries, and all have kind of like added to Tommy Wiseau's mystique, if you will. They got all that info, put it in this documentary, and Tommy Wiseau took them to court. This was back in 2017. They're from Canada. They're from Ontario, actually. So this was in an Ontario Superior Court. But they were going to release the doc in 2017, which is, of course, the same year The Disaster Artist came out. And basically, the judge found in favor of the filmmakers instead of Tommy Wiseau, saying that the lawsuit was a measure to kind of not ruin the positive potential buzz for The Disaster Artist. That Wiseau's kind of justification that they were making excessive use of clips from The Room as a kind of justification. The judge found in favor of the fair dealings doctrine, which basically says that if you are using clips in like a news item or in like an investigative piece, as long as you're not using them to excess, you are allowed to use them without necessarily having to secure the rights to using them. The judge found that the clips used, which is about 7 minutes of clips used in the Room documentary, do fall under the fair dealings doctrine. So Tommy Wiseau has to pay these guys $700,000, Canadian, I assume. So $550,000 for, you know, court costs and lost revenue and all that, plus an extra $200,000 for punitive damages. So we're going to see this at some point. I don't know when. The filmmakers said that they're probably going to be looking at streaming options, which undoubtedly makes the most sense, but the film probably comes out 3 years too late. I think the fact that they've now made a movie based on the making of The Room, based on The Disaster Artist, you know, maybe the time has come and gone. It will probably, however, be an interesting Trivial Pursuit question. What is Tommy Wiseau's real name? Number 9 is that James Mangold has officially been confirmed as the filmmaker of Indiana Jones 5. Frank Marshall, who's the producer of the Indiana Jones films, confirmed it in an interview With Collider, he said that Steven Spielberg is out. Steven Spielberg has apparently said everything he wants to say. And another interesting tidbit, Frank Marshall said that they're just actually now starting the writing process for Indiana Jones 5, which is bizarre because you'd think that they've been talking about this for years since Lucasfilm bought, or since Disney bought Lucasfilm, rather, that this was like, first they were going to bring Star Wars back, and then they were going to get Indiana Jones 5 going, and I think it was supposed to come out this summer, and then it's been pushed back to 2021. Now it's pushed back to 2022 because of COVID, but apparently they're now just starting to script the thing, which makes me wonder, you know, again, and I think we talked about this earlier on the show, what is this for? Who is this for? It's quite bizarre that, you know, it flashes back to Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which kind of really satisfied no one. Although some people like me thought it was an okay Indiana Jones movie, perfectly enjoyable in its own right. But, you know, who is this for? Why are they making this? It's clearly not for any specific imperative other than we can. And without Steven Spielberg now, without George Lucas, you have like two of the three main creative forces of this movie saying thanks, but no thanks. Why are they even bothering? Who knows? Number eight is the making of this film, Killers of the Flower Moon, which is Martin Scorsese's follow-up to The Irishman. This is another situation where Scorsese wanted to make The Irishman, couldn't find a backer, so it went to Netflix, and Netflix backed him, and it ended up being the most expensive movie that Netflix ever funded. Was it worth it? Netflix doesn't share its information in terms of how many watches and all that kind of thing, so it's not really certain. But now we have Apple getting in the Scorsese business. Apple is going to fund the majority of the $200 million budget for this movie, which is based on a book about 1920s murders in the Osaganay First Nation in the Western United States. Sounds like not something a studio would spend $200 million on without Scorsese involvement, but Paramount will distribute it. Apple's going to cough up most of the funding. Leonardo DiCaprio's in it, so is Robert De Niro. So there is some star power attached. It'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, if this is going to be like a model for Apple, because they're teaming up with a old-fashioned studio to do an old-fashioned theatrical release, then Apple will get the exclusive streaming rights. So, you know, we'll see if this is maybe Apple entering the movie game, because they've already entered the TV game with Apple TV+. Number seven. I'm calling these, like, sort of new couples casting, new buddy movie combos that have all been announced that sound interesting. So first we have Good, Bad, and Undead, which stars Peter Dinklage and Jason Momoa as Van Helsing and a vampire who are basically con men who go from town to town. Momoa pretends to attack people, and Van Helsing, played by Dinklage, pretends to vanquish Momoa. That could be really interesting and funny. Karen Gillan and Awkwafina are teaming up for Shelley. In the movie, Karen Gillan plays Awkwafina's former high school bully. Awkwafina has been so disillusioned by her high school bullying experience that she is now a hit woman, and she gets hired to take out the Karen Gillan character, and calamity and hilarity ensue. And then finally, the other one is Ball and Chain, which features Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt as a superhero couple who are having issues. I don't know if I see Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt as a couple, but the film is being written by Emily V. Gordon, who also co-wrote The Big Sick, which is a nice tie to this week's movie review, as you'll hear later on. Number six item is that Bill and Ted Face the Music, which we still don't know whether that's coming out in theaters this summer as planned. It's supposed to come out in August. It still might. We'll see what happens. But apparently it wouldn't have happened without Steven Soderbergh's involvement. Soderbergh was doing an interview where he's talking about his upcoming project, Mosaic, which is a limited series for HBO, but it also has like an interactive component. But Soderbergh is talking about how he worked with Ed Solomon on that project. Ed Solomon is the guy who wrote the first two Bill and Ted movies and wrote the third one. And Solomon showed Soderbergh the script, and then Soderbergh started getting on the phone to the people who own the rights to Bill and Ted and found the director, Dean Perrazzo. And it's just a fascinating little insight that we would not be getting Bill and Ted Face the Music if it weren't for the indie of indies, Steven Soderbergh. So, thanks, Soderbergh, wherever you are. I mean, if you like Bill and Ted, maybe not. Number five is that we are getting a Scarface remake, and the person hired to do it is Luca Guadagnino, who you may know as the director of The Bigger Splash, Call Me By Your Name, and the Suspiria remake. Now he's remaking Scarface, which, you know, then the 83 Scarface starring Pacino, directed by De Palma, itself was a remake of a Howard Hawks movie from 1932. Both films follow the same storyline about a gangster on the rise and, you know, fall from grace and all that. It's fascinating that you have Guadagnino. Of all people, this is like as mainstream as he's ever gotten so far, coming in to make this movie, and with a script by the Coen brothers. This is going to be some wacky stuff if this comes to fruition. Either that, or it's going to completely fall apart, because these are guys with very distinctive voices coming together on a project that I can't imagine would be seen as anything but derivative if it wasn't for the involvement of people like the Coen brothers or Guadagnino. So I think this is a project to watch. It is going to be wacky. It is going to be out there. They have a big job ahead of them to make something that's really distinct and really different from the De Palma film, which is, of course, iconic. And, you know, posters of it exist in half the dorm rooms in the country. So we'll see what happens. Also on the agenda at some point is they are sending Tom Cruise to space. It is it is the linchpin for the Tom Cruise experiment of trying to kill himself while making a movie to actually finally go to outer space. This does have the backing of NASA and SpaceX. So they are literally going to send Tom Cruise to the International Space Station to make a movie in space, directed by Doug Liman. There's no studio yet. But it's part of this interesting trend on the part of NASA that they have gotten more and more involved in, like, taking an active participation in projects that highlight the space program. And in the last year, they made 143 docs. Well, not NASA, but they participated in 143 docs, 25 feature films, including First Man, and 41 TV shows. So there's a first draft of the script. No one knows what else is going to be in it, or who else is going to be in it, or what else is going on. It's very, very tentative right now. But Tom Cruise is going to space to make a movie, as you knew he would eventually. Number three is Tenet is still on track for its July 17th release. They released another trailer a couple of weeks ago, and at the very end of the trailer it says, only in theaters, so no matter what happens, no matter if this release date is postponed, it is going to be in theaters at some point. And when it is in theaters, there was a report from Variety, or one of the trades, that they are going to need 80% of the theaters in the world to be open in order for this thing to have a chance at making a profit, or maybe even just make money, make enough money to cover the film. Forget the fact that it is a massive project. Maybe just even to break even, they need 80% of the theaters in the film, in the world, to open. So remarkable. There's a month and a half to July 17th, so who knows what might happen. Things change fast, but I think in the next couple of weeks are going to be very, very key. They're going to have to make some kind of bet in the next couple of weeks about whether or not we'll see Tenet this summer. They're going to have to actually hold to the 17th release or pull it back entirely, and keep your eyes open for that decision in the weeks to come. Number two is the sudden departure of Ruby Rose from Batwoman. This is huge because, of course, Batwoman is a big component of the Arrowverse on TV, but also because Batwoman is the, you know, like TV's first big lesbian superhero. And so to see the star of that, too, who identifies herself as LGBT, to depart after first season, it was apparently mutual. Rose, who's done a lot of film work, seemed to not enjoy the grind of network TV, which involves very long hours, of course, because it's Batman, a lot of night shoots. So it was very strenuous on her. She also had an onset injury at some point doing a stunt. So she was not enjoying the Batwoman experience and is now moving on, which is sad because it leaves a big hole in the Arrowverse roster. And now they're having to try and find someone who can fill that hole and try and do it as discreetly as possible because of just the chaos this has created. Speaking of chaos, the number one story is the Snyder Cut. The Zack Snyder edit of Justice League is getting released on HBO Max in the States, which is the new Warner Brothers streaming service. I don't know how it would be released here in Canada. I imagine we will get some kind of release here in Canada on Crave or something, maybe Netflix, who knows. I have extraordinary doubts of how many people want to see Zack Snyder's vision, and I put that in quote marks for these superheroes, considering it's so thoroughly rejected in Batman v Superman. The worldwide box office for Batman v Superman and Justice League together is probably just slightly more than Aquaman alone, which should tell you everything about sort of how people feel about Snyder's vision for these superheroes. This appeals to a very small, I think, fan contingent, and I think, frankly, the most toxic version of fandom, unfortunately. And now you have people demanding the David Ayer's cut of Suicide Squad, which was, of course, you know, there's a story about how that was kind of taken away from Ayer's, and it's like, when does it end? You know, when does it end, people? When can we just sort of let movies be? Yes, Justice League was not a great movie, but as I've said before, I didn't leave Justice League wanting to cut myself the way when I left Batman v Superman, which was just absolutely horrid in the way it approaches both, I think, the superheroes' characters themselves and the audience. And I'll say it again, Snyder's vision just didn't click with the majority of audience, which is why he's no longer involved in these movies. So to just throw $20 and $30 million to finish his vision, which people, a very small contingent of people, are so desperate to see, I think is a waste of time, effort, energy, and importantly, money. And speaking of time, that is the end of the time for our news wrap. We've got Lovebirds, the review, coming up next. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
For you.
It's her and me!
And him!
Yes! From,
Who the f*** are you?
Who the f*** are we? We're the people who want some answers, bitch! The bigger question is, who the f*** are you?
What are you doing in my fucking room?
We're here.
Ow!
Why would you do that?
Yeah. Why would we do that? That's what you want to know.
We're asking the questions. And the answers to our questions better be answers. But the answers to your questions are gonna be my fists.
What? Ow!
And that was a clip from The Lovebirds. It's the new film from Michael Showalter, and it stars Camille Nanjiani, Issa Rae, Anna Camp, Paul Sparks, Nicholas X. Parsons, and Kyle Bornheimer. I am now being joined on the line by the marrying man himself, Peter Wesley Salmon. Peter, how are you today?
What's up, y'all? What did you say?
I called you the marrying man.
Oh, the marrying man. Heck yeah, I am. It blew up on Facebook, so you've all probably seen, but I am now engaged. And yeah, October I'll be a husband. This is silly, but this is film. I got to bring it up. I'll be getting married just a few days before the classic. Well, it'll be a classic in the future. Hubby Halloween. The Adam Sandler film. So that's, I think, pretty perfect for me. So, yeah. I hope you all enjoy Hubby Halloween. I will be enjoying it as a hubby. So, yeah. It's not my biggest excitement for being married, but I don't know. It's pretty sweet and related to a film. So, yeah.
It all worked out then.
Yeah. It did. Yeah. I'll tell you the one thing. If anybody's engaging, it's harder during the quarantine, but you can always do what you got to do. You can, you know, there's still jewelers out there. You can get some dealings going with and such. But yeah, it was a wild ride.
So you bought the ring and everything while the quarantine was on?
Yeah, I did. I had to wear a mask and meet up behind, I forget the jeweler's place, the main one downtown, right next to Play With Clay. That guy, I would meet him behind his little alley, and he'd be wearing, you know, like a nice suit and a little gas mask, and I would, you know, be there too. Yeah, it was really sketchy. It was more like we were doing some, you know, drug dealings or whatever, but it was, yeah, I got it done and it was cool.
Well, I'm glad all that's on the record so that, you know, the future Sim and kids can hear all about the drug deal, about getting the engagement ring, and how it was twice the occasion because an Adam Sandler movie came out.
Exactly. Well, twice, that's an understatement, yeah. No. I thought it was funny that stands out. No, the best thing is I'll be marrying Mackie.
All right.
Yeah.
Now that we saved that, we're here to talk about The Lovebirds, which is a new film on Netflix, and you were very eager to review this. And
yeah, I always like the Showalter dude, so fun to check out.
Well, why don't you start by talking about why you were eager to review this, other than if it's timely thematically in your life.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, it was a bit. Personally, I just love Michael Showalter. I remember back in like 05 renting, or 06, whenever it came out, renting The Baxter, and just, yeah, being a fan of his, Wet Hot American Summer. I think we did Big Sick, right? It was really great. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just excited for this one. And especially because the Marvel thing going on too, Kumail Nanjiani, and he's just, you know, he's so booming. So that adds some excitement too. And I have not seen Issa Rae, like any of her work, I think her HBO show. So I kind of wanted to, you know, dive into that, be able to say I've seen her in some work. And those were all the kind of things that stood out to me. And it's Netflix, it's free streaming, right? Well, not free, but I don't have to pay $13.
Right. Right, that's part of the story, of course, that The Lovebirds was picked up by Netflix after the pandemic started. It was going to get its premiere at South by Southwest, and then that was canceled because of COVID.
Yeah, that's a great point. It is. I've seen a lot of people online kind of complain that this is not like Big Sick level.
That is, they say it's not.
Yeah, I think that makes more sense than South by Southwest. That's more of a, I don't know, it's got kind of more of an artsy scene to it, I guess. Well, this is more just kind of a blockbuster comedy.
Yeah, that's a great point. It is, I've seen a lot of people online kind of complain that this is not like Big Sick level.
No, it's not. No. No, I don't think it's at the Big Sick level, but I don't think it's like a crap comedy. Like, I don't think it's equivalent to, you know, like Hot Tub Time Machine or, you know, comedies of that nature. I don't know. I personally, I thought it was not to the quality of Big Sick, but I thought it was a fun time. I thought it was a fun little rompus, you know? What were your thoughts?
No, I thought it was definitely fun. It was kind of a throwback. I think there's a lot of kind of 80s style comedy in it that we're just kind of out on the town having fun, getting in danger, because the danger is legit in it as well. It's a murder mystery. It's funny, but on the other hand, like, people are getting killed all over the place.
Yeah, there's a lot more violence in it than I thought there would be. I was very okay with that. The one frat scene, just a quick shot, and you see, yeah, there's maybe a double digit of dead bodies there. So I thought that was a lot of fun. That stood out to me. Like what you were saying, Big Sick, it was a dramedy. This was just a straight up comedy. But I do want to say, like Big Sick, it had a sprinkle more depth than a lot of comedies do. And I thought, like, you know, all the reviewers are saying, and I think especially just because of Kumail Nanjiani and Issa Rae's performance, they're a couple, and it was pretty darn lovable. At least that's what I found. And just great back and forth, very comedic, you know? And I thought a bit more in depth than other, you know, dual characters, especially in romantic comedies. Did you enjoy the performance?
Yeah, no, they were great. They make the movie, absolutely. I think the one thing where the movie kind of screws up is it's implied through the whole thing that they're having difficulties as a couple, and that's not really sold in the performances, because there's clearly chemistry, and they are.
I guess, yeah. I don't know. The first scene, it's a pretty major fight, but yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean. There's no surprise when they start falling for each other again.
Right. I even in the quote unquote fight, I don't sense any animosity or even any kind of like fatigue with the relationship. It's
clear. Well, a lot of the times, and their friend mentions it later, it's like cute arguments, the kind of arguments couples that, like, you know, are really good together argue about, you know, like they're arguing about like such small things that, you know, it was just nice in the sense that they knew that about each other, you know? So yeah, I get what you mean in that sense. There was some tension in the car, in the car scene when they're, there was some tension for sure. So, you know, there was a pinch of me that was like, oh gosh, I hope they don't break up. But yeah, there was definitely sprinkles of love throughout the whole thing, even if they tried hard not to express that.
There was tensions in that moment in the car, but the tensions are kind of forgotten once, like, the murder mystery starts, and even in the scene before that, because they're fighting about The Amazing Race, and then they come to fight about reality TV shows, and it's just this kind of, like, silly banter back and forth, and like, except for that, again, that one little scene in the car, which is kind of scripted. I mean, obviously, because it's a movie and things are scripted, but it just feels like there has to be something between them to take the whatever drama we're instilling into this comedy up a notch, as opposed to just like letting them riff, letting them just get around town trying to solve this murder mystery. Because it's hilarious to me that they're wholly inadequate to try and solve this mystery, but they're very gung-ho to do it, or at least the Issa Rae character is gung-ho to do it. And there's a scene where the Kumail Nanjiani character says, like, we can't even figure out our relationship. How are we supposed to figure out, like, what's going on with this mystery? And I think there was a way that they could, you know, they're clearly in over their head. They've clearly watched one too many cop shows and figure that this all is easy. And I didn't need this made up friction, because it felt like it wasn't really there at all.
Okay, so you would have just preferred if, like, they never even broke up for the whole film. It was just that little, like, they were just like totally fine the whole film. Or, like, they had kind of... Yeah, well, okay, I get that.
They had issues, but yeah.
I thought they had some issues again later after they thought they solved it for the first time. But even then, yeah, they still had some elements of love. What I did like, though, the one scene, though, where, because of their breakup, you know, Kumail Nanjiani had the doubts about whether Issa Rae, Leilani liked him, right? So, and he's mainly jealous because of the one friend. And then he, at the party, talks with the friend, and the friend just talks about how much Issa Rae, you know, Leilani talks about G-Bron, and makes him realize, like, oh, okay, see, yeah, I'm her one, right? And then Leilani has the same conversation with that individual's boyfriend, and, you know, it kind of makes her realize, like, oh, okay, he's pretty cool, too. So, like, I know what you mean, like, I never really doubted they'd be back together, but, I don't know, that scene was heartwarming, so... I think just the fact that they were broken up and that scene being allowed was, I was okay with it in that sense. I was glad they broke up just for kind of, you know, the scenes of warmth of that nature.
Well, the interesting thing about what happened at that party, the party scene you're talking about, is that it kind of gets around something that I think the movie, I don't know if it wants to talk about it, but it's an interesting thing it kind of stumbles into, because there's, Issa Rae is talking to the one of her friends and is talking about how, well, they're always posting these great Instagram pics of, you know, the wonderful life they're leading. And her friend says, well, I'm just doing that to make, you know, my ex-boyfriends who follow me on social media jealous. And here Issa Rae is comparing her relationship to this other relationship that has a level of fakeness, or I guess more like a level of performance, and she's comparing her relationship with Camille Nanjiani to this, you know, performative relationship, and there's something to that that's kind of very interesting to explore, especially in the midst of you have this couple thinking that, you know, they're Nick and Nora from The Thin Man, and they're both vastly unqualified to be solving mysteries.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I never thought about that. Yeah, it shows how blind they are for mysteries. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, also, it was just a good glimpse into, you know, unfortunately, how things work, right? Like, when you look on social media, who knows how they're really doing, right? Like, Bradgelina and stuff, they look the best, you know, things like that. And, like, they break up, so, you know. Right. Never base your relationship off of social media.
That's a good lesson.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe I never even thought that while watching it. Yeah, if she couldn't have gotten that, then why is she trying to solve the murder? Yeah, so that was like a little kind of sprinkle in there. I think Showalter definitely did a bit more depth than usual kind of just slapstick rom-coms have. Mm-hmm. Would you agree? Would you say it's at least a pinch? You got a pinch more depth in them?
I don't know how much depth there is. I think when people are comparing it to Big Sick, it's the same director, same star. But that's like a deeply personal story that had a lot of lightheartedness in it, true, but it was also a deeply personal story about, you know, one man and one woman's real life courtship and the extraordinary circumstances they're in. This is just for fun. This is just silly, silly fun.
But it's fun, but I think it's the kind of comedic fun structured in as, you know, high quality ways you could without it going to the next level of dramedy or some jazz like that.
No, there's no jazz, which I appreciate. I think I think when it comes to something like this, and I'm kind of glad it came out on Netflix, because I
would have gotten. Yeah, this is perfect for Netflix. This would, I think, maybe even flop at the box office.
Right, IndieWire, the IndieWire review I read said, I wrote the quote down, but now I've lost it. But it basically said, like, it's the perfect sort of Netflix film, because it's got that, like, algorithmic kind of mathematical thing that would, like, allow it to pop up if you are regularly watching, like, comedies and rom-coms and this kind of thing. It's like, why don't you watch next? The Lovebirds, and it seems very natural that this would come up in your queue at some point, because it checks a whole lot of different boxes. Something like this would have gotten buried at the multiplex, because...
Maybe because it's Kumail, it would have done okay, but yeah, I don't... Or in Issa Rae too, but yeah, no, not nearly as successful as if it was on Netflix.
Right, but like the attitude for movies now, they have to be like either... very big, like they have to be like the Avengers or the Star Warses of the world, or they have to be like life-altering. They have to be like the Parasites or the Irishmans and this kind of thing. Like, they either have to be super prestigious or super blockbustery, and there's just not a lot of room for something like The Lovebirds, even in the expectations of filmgoers. You can't just... It's an 87-minute silly little comedy about two people trying to solve a murder mystery that ends up leading them to an orgy and then a crooked cop. and all the things along the way, and people are saying, like, but it did not have this serious relationship component I've come to expect from the work of Michael Showalter and Kumail Nanjiani. And it's like, as you said at the top, it's like, have they never seen Wet Hot American Summer? That's...
Yeah, exactly. Even the Baxter's kind of silly, you know? Well, not kind of silly, it's ridiculously silly. It's, you know, American dude trying to be British, right? I think pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a wild ride.
Right. It's interesting too that the script, and it, when the names popped up on the credits at the beginning, really clicked with me, I guess, sort of having had an appreciation for Canadian cinema, which exists, but the screenwriters were the filmmaking team behind Young People Blanking, which came out about 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. What was that work about?
It's about four couples trying to be intimate, basically, and it's like the various complexities of intimacy. That I would not say it's like Couples Retreat, but there's one couple that's divorced and trying to hook up just for, you know, fun. There's one couple who are trying to, like, start a friends with benefits arrangement, and then there's another couple that is trying a threesome, and then there's another couple who are getting together for the first time, and it's
so, you know, it's like that, but they picked one couple and made that the focus
with a murder mystery.
Yeah. I like it.
But I mean, Young People Blanking has a lot of the same issues, I think, where it's like it's trying to walk around to saying something that doesn't quite get there, but at the same time, it's still this fun little naughty romp that, you know, you can appreciate. And I remember, too, the controversy about Young People Blanking because of the title, because it's not called Young People Blanking, it's insert the word.
Oh, okay, see, I didn't get that. I didn't know what you're talking about. I've seen that film. I saw that film when it came out, yeah. I'll tell you what, I was when did it come out? I think I was only, like, 13, 14, maybe.
I think it was 08, 09.
So, yeah, I was around there. I got it, because, you know, I was kind of hoping maybe there'd be, you know, maybe nudity and such, but...
Nudity, yeah.
No, it was because of all the controversy I had heard about, too, right?
Yeah, there was a conservative MP that wanted to, like, pull, like, funding for, like, the telefilm.
Yeah, and it was just some plain Jane old film. It was fun, but it was, yeah, it was...
It's perfectly
fun. Not as graphic as people kind of made it seem.
But the title is meant to be provocative, obviously.
Oh yeah. And that was very provocative.
But I mean, it's coming from that same team. There's a lot of humor. There's some warmth. But I mean,
I would say more than some warmth with the couple. Yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. So it's,
like the scene where she talks about. I guess it's got some sappiness. I don't know, but like when she mentions how she has read his work, and like mm-hmm. find out that the only reason he hasn't shown it to her is not because he thinks he's better than everybody, because, you know, he has some doubt and stuff, you know.
Yeah, he's a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, it was a little sappy, but you know, I liked that there was some, you know, elements like that that made the two main characters more vibrant than a lot of other comedies.
Right. I'm just trying to get
the fireworks part. I enjoyed the Katy Perry fireworks. I thought Kumail Nanjiani did a phenomenal job. He was a great singer, and I think he should stop this acting and focus only on that. So yeah, the fireworks. Fireworks, I guess, was a little sappy, but I think it's good for a couple's film. Yeah.
He should probably work out his singing voice as much as he does his upper body.
I don't know. It started bad, but then when he started, like, legit crooning, I don't know. I was trembling. I enjoyed it.
It's interesting because the films ride so much on them. There aren't too many actors.
It's solely on them. No, there's nobody else.
No, yeah, it's interesting. It's just
the villain dude, Paul Sparks. He's freaky.
Yeah, he was a little out there. He's strung out, and
he always seems like he's strung out. He's the main villain in Castle Rock, and he's not in it, but he seems strung out as heck, like very, very drugged up. I don't know. That's just how he was born, I guess. Go ahead and use it for his acting, you know? So good on him.
Are you saying he was born that way?
Yeah, I guess.
But it, you know, Anna Camp is also in this, and I was kind of disappointed there wasn't more Anna Camp. But
who did she play? Was she the
she rich? Was? Yeah, she was the couple that gets Camille Nanciani kicked in the chest by a horse.
Yeah, that scene was the most like just legit late 90s, 2000s kind of like bromance film. You know what I mean? Like American Pie, or like old school or Road Trip or some film where something silly about a butt and a donkey is going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
Any film. Any film that has to, like Animal House, that has to do with the frat place too, you know? An animal doing that. Yeah, it was a very, as someone who grew up watching those kinds of films, I enjoyed that scene. But it did kind of stand out as, oh, okay, this is a little maybe too rompy for this, you know? But it was funny, I laughed, so.
Oh no, there's laughs all over the place. I was kind of surprised how much I did laugh out loud, because
I like Michael Showalter, but like, yeah. You know, the reviews weren't great, and the trailers didn't, you know, get me too hyped. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised when it comes to that.
And I'd read a lot of reviews too that had been mixed, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's got okay, but it's not nearly as much as the Big Sick.
Oh no, of course.
But
not.
I don't know if you reviewed it, but he did Hello, My Name is Doris too, right? I don't know how that did. But I don't think it did very well.
Showalter did that?
Yes.
Hello, My Name is Doris. I don't remember that. What is that about?
Sorry, one sec.
Are we both looking it up? Oh, sure. It's Sally Field comedy where she plays an older woman who's basically learning how to live again.
Yeah. It was by him, right?
Yeah, I think I remember.
I remember it did very well.
I remember seeing the ads about it. I don't remember seeing it.
Yeah. So yeah, people like just talking about Big Sick. It's like that's not all he did. In fact, he's done some after that since this. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think it's important to note to not view it as it's going to be a critically acclaimed drama of that nature. Just fun time.
Yeah, no, I
use the word like five times, but it's a fun little rompus.
It's a fun romp, to be sure. I think that it's 87 minutes long, but I think there are parts of it too, unfortunately, that I don't know if it feels longer. I don't think it feels long at all, but there are parts where it kind of feels like the wheels kind of start spinning. It feels like it kind of gets trapped in like the mud as it's kind of going down this dirt road, and it kind of gets stuck for a minute before it takes off again.
Yeah, near the end, I totally get what you mean. It did kind of continue on a bit too long. But the second I started feeling that, that's when they go to the cops for the first time, and the cop just kind of let them know what's going on, and that kind of made me like, oh, okay, that's, you know. Because that the comment that the cop makes connects to kind of everything prior, so it kind of brightened my viewpoint of that disappointment we were just talking about, with it kind of going up and down too much, or dragging on too much.
I did like how it kind of lampshaded like those expectations where they finally do get picked up by the police, and they're like, no, we know you're innocent, we've been looking for
you. That's what I was talking about, yeah. That was one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah, no.
Wait, I totally know what you mean, because right before that it was starting to drag on a bit. And I was like, okay, this is, yeah, I get it. You're trying to solve the crime.
Well, right before that is the part where they're at the orgy, and it's discovered that,
you know,
they are not meant to be there. They are intruders into the great orgy society of New Orleans.
Oh, when they take their masks off?
Right.
Yeah, and, that is funny.
And it's like, you hit that moment and you're like, okay, where does it go from here? Like, what's the next natural pivot from here? And that whole sequence was a little too Eyes Wide Shut for my liking, but I mean,
like the whole Swinners like scene was a bit too much.
Well, with the whole masks and everything.
Yeah, it had a real like surreal vibe to it. It was strange.
And not only
it
that,
was,
but
it
like...
was kind of like the ending of Logan's Run, where like they do the kind of like just like they do the exact same thing. Like they decide whose name comes up, and then it's those names that they, you know, like kill. I guess. Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering what was going to happen, but then no, it was a Swingers thing.
Right, no, but
like I saw their masks, I was like, yo, this is a Swingers thing, and then they go to the play and I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have assumed it was a Swingers thing. That's just, come on, Peter, we're disgusting. And then it turned out to be a Swingers thing. So yeah, it was a wild ride. Is this Swingers? Is this not Swingers?
Well, no, I figured it was because of the whole thing with Anna Camp and her husband earlier, and then with the whole orgy discussion about whether or not orgies just happen, whether you need to schedule them and everything.
I thought the part with the husband that you were talking about when he's wearing the mask in a way to try to scare them, she has him take it off, but I'm not gonna lie, I was kind of scared. That kind of mask scared me. I'd be very scared.
I think my problem with that sequence is like the masks themselves are so over the top. They're wearing like these huge, like, it's like somebody painted some traffic cones for people to wear.
Yeah. Well, they're like a classic kind, right? Like Commedia dell'arte or whatever from way back. And it's because it's got such a luxurious vibe to it, right? And that's what they all are. They're rich. So, yeah, it's just a representation of the high class.
I suppose. But I thought it was unnecessarily over the top. But to each their own. I think that... I think that as we've been talking about the last few minutes here, there are just things, there are times when the movie just kind of flows, and it's mostly just, and I wonder how much of it was, you know, Camille Nanjiani and Issa Rae were kind of allowed to riff, because they're both very talented comedic people.
And it's Showalter, so I would feel there definitely would have been some allowed for sure.
Right. Because I mean, those are great scenes. Like the whole scene when they're in a restaurant, they're talking about how they bring you the extra bit of the milkshake and the cup, and
yeah. Oh, that was probably one of my favorite scenes. Yeah. That's kind of why I brought up Hot Tub Time Machine, because it is the kind of film where there's a lot of improv, right? But it shows in both of them, even the first one that got good reviews, it shows because sometimes the scenes, the jokes will go on too long, right? And you'll actually see the actors' faces start to be just the real one. You know it's gone like that, right? Whereas in this, yes, it's improv, but it was edited and there was enough directing that it never seemed as such. It was just, it felt like they were being real. It didn't feel like they're doing high-quality improv. It just felt like they were doing high-quality jokes that through the improv gave it a very real vibe. So I was very impressed with that, whether it was, you know, just them or, you know, the editor or Showalter's directing. I thought... yeah, they did improv and improv elements the best way you could.
I mean, improv is very, very hard to do, and even in live, but it's especially harder to do in film because, you know, you have to have all your angles covered and you have to make sure both actors are able to riff at basically the same level. And I'm not sure how much, you know, maybe rehearsal or leeway everybody was given, but I mean, there is definitely a feeling that that not everything in this was scripted, that there was definitely some riffing, and it's very, very fortunate that both the actors are accomplished at a certain level. At least it feels like it, or at least maybe it's just, you know, their chemistry. Whatever it was working on this film. And if you take either Camille Nanjiani or Issa Rae out of the equation, if you lose one of them, I don't think this film works as well as it did. And I think
no, not at all. No, it's the kind of film where, yeah, you need the actors. You need the actors to be great. Yeah, it's like that with a lot of comedies, right? Like with Blues Brothers, like that was very dependent on who they picked. Wayne's World, like all those kinds of things. So, but I think this one in an even stronger way, or I guess more important way, because they got that romance too, and that's especially hard to get. And yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great like couples film. Like it's better than you know, like all those Ryan Reynolds, Jason Bateman ones, like The Changeup, wasn't that them? And all the, those kinds of
yeah,
films.
Yeah,
I thought this one was of a higher quality.
Right, The Changeup is a really great example in terms of, like, you can bring great comedians into a comedy, but just having that doesn't make it work. And because, you know, like, Ryan Reynolds and Jason Bateman are really great on their own, but I'm not sure how well they worked together.
No, whereas this was, like, really in sync. Yeah, they were great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what were your thoughts on the villain? I enjoy him, but I don't know. I think maybe they should have gone with just a more regular kind of villain, I guess. Or I don't know. Did you like his kind of creepy vibes? His creepy vibes match the rich and what they were doing, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure.
I know he didn't know the rich. I just mean, I don't know. It worked well with that atmosphere.
I'm not sure I bought the motivation, because it's one of those things where it feels like the screenplay was going through all these various, like, joke ideas that they had, going to the frat guy's apartment, then going to the dinner party, and then going to the orgy, and then, you know, where do you go from there? Well, we still need to have the villain come back in and actually threaten them, and it seemed like, I've been a cop for such and such years, and I haven't been able to, you know, earn a good living, so I was working security for these orgy people, and then blackmailing them on the side. It gets a little convoluted in terms of his
he just gives a story to kind of fill everything up for us.
But I
think it did that kind of comedic way too, but yeah, maybe a bit too much there.
Yeah, it's I'm not sure the package that they present at the end in terms of why all of this unfurled works especially, but I will forgive it because it's an hour and a half long. And it was funny enough, and we get a nice little epilogue with Camille and Issa actually in the amazing.
Nice, that race. Was I put a note for that. I just put 10 out of 10 ending scene. Like, I loved it. Perfect for comedy. Yeah, which is great. Comedy, like a romantic comedy, they're perfect when there's just such a firm conclusion like that, you know? Everything is just firmly concluded and proper and well done, and everything's good, you know? Everything's coming up Milhouse, and I loved it.
And I think it might set up a nice sequel to have them, like, actually in The Amazing Race and follow them in The Amazing Race.
That'd be cool. Or if there's ever, like, a celebrity Amazing Race, they do it together. That'd be cool.
Oh, yeah. No, that in real life. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you meant that. Yeah.
No, I meant for, like, a sequel to Lovebirds. Lovebirds 2 : The Amazing Race or something like that.
that'd be fun.
I will leave that with Mr. Showalter, and we'll see.
Also, I was a little disappointed with... Like, it was pretty good. Like, the dorm scene, the frat one, I enjoyed the late 90s, 2000s song they were playing. The do-do-do, I think it was that one, right? I enjoyed that. Because it's true, it's true. You know, people my age, I guess I'm older than the frat boys, but the 20-year cycle thing isn't true all the time. But for a lot of music, it is. Like, I love that kind of music so much. It just represents the kind of... comedy works of, you know, my youth. Mm-hmm. But anyways, even though I really liked that one song, the soundtrack didn't stand out to me at all. Like, I can't even really think of any score music, including it, like, the speed scene. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, I guess that could have been a bit better. Although, maybe it was, like, purposeful, because you're just more immersed in, you know, the real place where there isn't music playing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Music was not an important element of it. I just said, you know, I noticed... that nothing caught my attention when it comes to it. And it was by the dude that made that Mad World song. So I think I was just kind of hoping for a pinch more.
Well, you can't have everything.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right.
No,
Peter.
Overall, I would say if you like comedy, yeah, or just a couple films, yeah, check it out for sure.
All right. And if people want to register for your wedding, how can people get in touch with you?
We're not doing a wedding. We're just still open, actually. So
I'm trying to get you to talk about where people can find you on the internet.
Oh, okay, I get it. Mr. Towerack, YouTube and Twitter, and I'll say, yeah, again, Mackie or Mackenzie Zetigis, articles for Screen Rant. So Check them out, y'all.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean. Or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. You can find me on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph, and that is with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out guelphpolitico.ca for my news and politics stuff. And meanwhile, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back, of course, next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we will, of course, catch you then.